Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Founders Club Radio.
Welcome to the Founders Club, where each week we talk to the founders and leaders of great private companies. I'm your host, John Coffin, and this morning I'm thrilled to have Babette Hennigan, the founder and managing director of Lynx Partners, and Linda Figg, the CEO and president of Figg Bridge Companies. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome, and we're so thrilled to have both of you here in the studio. Linda, I'm going to start with you. Thank you so much for coming up from your headquarters and hometown of Tallahassee, Florida.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Really excited to have you here. Tell our listeners about the scope of your business at Figg Bridge Companies, please.
Well, by the name itself, it kind of reveals a little bit about who we are. We are a company that exclusively specializes in bridges. That's the design, the inspection, the management, and the construction of bridges throughout the country. We've worked in 42 states and 6 foreign countries. Our customers have received 355 design awards, and that includes 3 presidential awards through the National Endowment for the Arts, and they've only given 5 of those awards for bridges, so we're very excited for our customers on that. We have offices in 6 states and 8 field offices right now. We'll have field offices that are associated with projects that are under construction at the time, so that varies. We're very passionate and enthusiastic about bridges and getting infrastructure built in America.
So you use the word customers. Who are your customers?
Well, we have state departments of transportation, authorities like turnpikes, counties, cities. We've even started a private initiative in which we are developing private bridges. But really, anyone who needs a bridge is our potential customer.
Okay, so it's really a diverse group of people that you're getting your projects from.
Yes.
Bring me back to the beginning. Your father began the business.
Yes, he did. In 1978, he started this company. He was actually in his early 40s at the time, had a passion for bridges, and it really sprung out of, after World War II, they needed to replace the bridges in Europe very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so they created a technology called precast concrete segmental.
Can you describe that a little bit?
Yes, it's like concrete as big Legos, where you take precast pieces and then you assemble them very quickly, like a kit of parts, and post-tension them together, and it allows you to have very high quality, low maintenance, and be able to build very quickly. This was not a method that was customarily used in the United States at the time, but there was a series of bridges in the Florida Keys that needed to be replaced, and it seemed to be a very practical solution for that and an avenue by which to advance technology in our country and take this process and this avenue for bridges and bring it to a whole nother level, really advance the technology even further, because there was many opportunities in this country and Europe really doesn't have as many bridges to accomplish. So my father started the company then with this whole perspective in mind. I was actually getting ready to enter my sophomore year of engineering school at Auburn University at the time. So as soon as I got out,
War Eagle,
yes. Oh yeah, we almost pulled it out on Saturday.
Yeah, sorry, we won't go there. Sorry.
Right after I graduated from engineering school there, Dad put me out on construction in the Florida Keys, and just loved it, and was very passionate about it. Worked with him for 20 years, and then in 2002 he passed away unexpectedly, and we continued to grow the company. Added a couple of offices, grew by about 40% in a couple of years, and decided to start a construction company in the middle of all that, too.
That's incredible. Describe that transition. So many of the great companies that we talk to or second or third generation companies. And there's yours was a little bit abrupt, obviously, but any advice during that process, or how did that go for you?
Well, I think my father had given me some words of encouragement before this happened, which was, you know, kind of fortuitous, I guess, because we were actually planning for him maybe to retire when he turned 75. He was 65. And I was really not, you know, that wasn't a big topic for me, because I really enjoyed working with my father. We were partners, friends. It was very exciting. But he said, you know, at some point, this company is going to be yours, and I think you will be able to take it further and do more with it than I have. And, you know, he was very complimentary and helpful. And about 2 months later, you know, he was diagnosed with leukemia and passed away. And so I held on to those words. And I think that communication between generations is really fundamentally important, even when the conversations, you know, may seem like they're not important at the time. They mm-hmm. they can hold some great strength as you move forward.
And I'm sure some of his guiding principles probably still are foundational to your company today.
Oh yes, we had a great foundation, and the people in our organization really rallied. You know, not one person left the company. I mean, we actually continued to grow, and we had a stint there for probably 2 to 3 years where every single thing we went after, we won. It was just an amazing, amazing time to grow the company.
That's incredible. Well, for you mentioned 41 states, 6 countries. I think that almost everyone has probably seen one of your bridges. There's the 7 Mile Bridge down in the Keys. There's MARTA. You've done work for MARTA here in Atlanta. And then you've done some just incredibly beautiful, what I would call works of art, really. My favorite is up in Penobscot, Maine. It's this incredible, incredible bridge up there. But talk about this whole element of functional, you know, there's obviously a lot of engineering and technology that goes into every project. There's a functional aspect of it, but there's also the beauty that you create. And talk about how you kind of meld all that together, because it's really remarkable outside looking in.
Well, thank you. I mean, when we first started the company, Federal Highway Administration had a program where any bridge that was over $10 million had to have an alternate design. So we came in as the alternate design because it was the most economical and the quickest to build. But what we also found was that they were winning awards for aesthetics because of the economy and the elegance and the efficiency of the design and the streamlined shapes were creating great beauty. So over time, we added a slogan called Creating Bridges as Art, because it's the art of the science, the aesthetic. You know, everything goes into the art of the bridge. We also have a slogan called Functional Bridge Sculpture. We like to think of them as sculptural works of art that are also economical and quick to build and low maintenance. So it kind of has the total package. Mm-hmm. And we have another slogan called Building Bridge Landmarks, because these are infrastructure that will be there for more than 150 years, and they become symbols of a community.
Sure.
And we believe that the quality of life in a community is represented by the infrastructure that people see there.
Is that typically your life expectancy of one of your bridges, is over 100 years?
Well, it used to be that the codes about 50 years ago said a bridge would last 50 years, and that's about the same time that we started our interstate program. So you can imagine we have a lot of bridges that need to be replaced. But now with the materials that we have today and the technology, we believe we can go well over 150 years.
Wow. So what is, you mentioned it, what is the magnitude of our infrastructure issue, I'll call it?
Well, there's over 600,000 bridges in the country. 1 in 4 is structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. That's over 150,000, 160,000 bridges that need to be replaced now. over the 50-year period of time since the interstate was built, the loads on our bridges have grown by 25%. The truck loads are heavier. And then you face that with the economic aspects of it, that most of the bridges have been built using gas tax money, but there's no increase in the gas tax. Our cars are becoming more fuel efficient, so the revenue is not there. So there has to be other ways to, you know, to accomplish getting infrastructure built. But there's a big need.
So there's this huge need, and it's part of the solution probably is a combination of federal, state, municipal or city, and then also private funding as well. I know you're starting to kind of get into that side of things. Can you speak a little bit about the future of the private funding of bridges?
Yes, we've always seen that there was a challenge to get major infrastructure built, especially at a local level where there isn't a lot of funding, or you have to wait for years to build up enough money to start a project. So innovative, creative financing has always been kind of a fundamental part of what we tried to help our customers with. But recently, we really pursued this effort of private bridges. And we did a bridge in Virginia, the South Norfolk Jordan Bridge over the Elizabeth River, which is replaced an 80-year-old lift bridge that just was in such bad condition that the city of Chesapeake had to close the bridge down. And it goes right to the Navy shipyard area and is a fundamental link across the river. So we came in and offered to do it 100% privately. So we teamed up with an equity partner and created United Bridge Partners to help communities get bridges built when there's no money.
And perhaps there was a couple of those on the drawing board.
Yes, we're getting ready to start construction early next year of another private bridge in East Chicago, Indiana, called the Klein Avenue Bridge, and we're looking at others as well.
Excellent. Linda, you mentioned private equity, so I'm going to shift to Babette. that was a perfect segue. Thank you. But Babette, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Lynx Partners, which for our listeners is one of the leading private equity groups in the Southeast and the nation, I'll say.
Well.
Would love to know a little bit about what your scope of business is.
Sure. Thank you so much for having us, and an honor to be here with Linda. So, as a small little aside, I used to own a post stress concrete wiring cable company. So.
Oh, my. Now, see, this is something I didn't know.
I didn't know it either.
This is great. In another life. Yeah. But thank you very much, John. Lynx Partners, I'm one of the founders and managing directors of Lynx Partners. And what we specialize on is really trying to be a partner with families and entrepreneurs as they are looking to build their company up to the next level. We are always what I would call the first institutional capital that might be coming in. Generally, our partners have something that causes a transaction to happen, i.e., either a generational transfer and they need capital. They're growing so fast and they need capital. They have a partner they need to who has decided to do something else in life and they need a partner. So we come in and structure a transaction where they are truly our partners. We own the same securities together. We go in together. We go out together. And so what we do is we focus on companies that are in the stage of sort of $20 to $100 million in revenue.
Okay.
And we are trying to help them and really give them tools for them to be able to grow and go up to the next level of where they want to go. So in many cases, what we're doing is helping them and giving them the courage to invest in that infrastructure, whether it's in technology or whether it's lean manufacturing or whether it's a stronger finance department. We will never be able to be as good as they are in terms of the relationships with their clients and their customers. But we can help them with sort of the back office side of that.
So you oftentimes serve as either a catalyst or an accelerator of growth.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
How did you get in the private equity business?
Well, luck. I have had two jobs in my life. The first one was at a firm called Bradford Ventures, which was started by my father, and I worked with him for 16 years. He's still working as an advisor to our firm. So back in 1981, when I came out with a biology degree and 20% interest rates and no jobs, he said, well, come work with me for 2 years and then you can go on to graduate school. And, you know, 18 years later, I was still there. So I really got a seat at the table that is very rare, and had the opportunity to sort of be in on the ground floor of private equity as it became back then, or there was no private equity. It was called bootstrap financing.
Right.
Were
you always focused on companies in that same target range,
yes,
kind of up to $150 million?
So my whole career has always been in that size range. Mm-hmm. I've never gone up further than that. I like that area because you really can affect growth and you really can see transformational growth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can zig and zag a little bit faster and a little bit quicker as opposed to trying to move a battleship. Right. And so we feel we can really have an impact there.
And then Lynx, so you took your experience from Bradford and then began Lynx.
So when we moved down here, when my husband and I moved down here with two little ones, one little one and one in the oven, after our second son was born, my husband sort of looked at me and said, what are you going to do next? So I was really blessed. I linked arms with two partners and created Lynx. And so we raised our first fund and bought five companies there, which we have built and grown. And then we raised our second fund, which is fully invested. And now we're raising our third fund. So, which we hope to which will close up in January, and that'll be my big Christmas present. So,
congratulations, that's incredible. So, how large do you think your third fund is?
I think it's
going to be
around $150 million, which is a nice size for the size companies that we're investing in. And our client base tends to be foundations, high net worth, family offices, and some insurance, you know, pension capital.
Okay. So this has been an interesting time to find new investors or existing investors. Having recently gone through that process, what have your observations been?
Well, the market has very much changed. Mm-hmm. Technology has come into the space, and so as well as a lot of competition. Investors have the opportunity to see every flavor of ice cream that's out there.
Right.
You have to decide whether, you know, we have to fit a niche. And if somebody is interested in the small buyout, industrial, energy, transportation, logistics space, I fit that niche. But, you know, if they want healthcare and they want technology and they want this or they want that, you know, we're not going to meet their needs when that comes up. So you have to really canvas a lot of the marketplace to find the person and the institutions that are looking for that space at that time when you're coming to market. And mm-hmm. so it's a much broader marketing challenge than it was previously.
Okay. So much, much easier, I guess, for the third fund than it would be for a first or second, I guess, because you've established your track record.
Sure. We have a proven track record. Our first fund was a net 18% fund to our clients. And so we've got, our numbers are good. But again, we tend to be small, so we're not going to be attractive to a large state pension plan that mm-hmm. needs to invest $100 million at a clip. So you have to find, again, you got to match your client to your product and to make sure you don't spend too much time in the wrong pond. And that's always tricky, you know.
Right. As a lot of our listeners are business owners or mm-hmm. entrepreneurs, and they're in that range of that you're interested in. What advice would you have to them as in that transition from running your own business, what are the things that they need to do to perhaps attract outside capital, sure. either institutional or otherwise?
Sure. I guess my I have a couple pieces of advice. First of all is don't do a transaction unless you like the people you're doing a transaction with.
Right.
Life is too short. Secondly is, and go back to that one, you know, it's chemistry.
Right.
If the chemistry is right, the cash will follow, right?
Can I ask a quick question on that? At the beginning, you know, when people are assessing different private equity partners, you know, everyone's going to have their best face on, I guess. But how do you kind of, what? How do you go in a little deeper on chemistry? You know, how do you test that or really kind of figure that out?
Sure. Well, you want to spend time because at the end of the day, people make you money, not products. Mm-hmm. And so you want to make sure that you have a chemistry together and you have the same vision together as to where you want to go. You also want to make sure you have the same ethics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you conservative? Are you aggressive? Are you, and how do you want to build? So that's important. Initially in these processes, you are having a conversation and talking about your companies. But then as you get further, you get deeper into the relationship and you see how they negotiate and you see how they're, you know, we use due diligence as trust but verify.
Mm-hmm.
If the due diligence is not coming up with what they've said, well, it's awfully hard to have a relationship if you're always sort of looking for the alligator, you know, hiding under the table.
Mm-hmm.
So we spend a lot of time on that. I mean, my advice to business owners, if they are really truly thinking about it, is, you know, go ahead and audit your statements.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and make sure your house is clean. You know, there are a lot of things you can do as a business owner that is your privilege, but if you're going to ask institutional capital to come in, don't get offended when, you know, they have a fiduciary duty to do the right thing and to do business the right way. So, you know, make sure you look at it through that lens. If you operate that way already, it makes it very easy to have the conversation.
Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned manufacturing, business services. What are specifically the industries that Lynx is focused on?
Sure, we have done 5 companies in the logistics space. So we have a very specific model in the logistics space that we look for, which is called basically a hybrid model, where we are working with companies that have drivers and their trucks as well as owner operators. We want to look at companies that have basically a radius of 200 miles around what the service they're providing. And the key to all of our companies is that they are providing a service to their clients, and they are doing that either with a truck or with a survey crew or with a specialty distribution model that is going into the petrochemical. But at the end of the day, you are servicing your client. And if that's the mentality of the owner, then we're going to probably have the same view on where to go with the business.
Okay. So you mentioned technology. It's clearly kind of key to innovation and lots of different things. How are some of your companies or opportunities really using technology to drive innovation or growth?
So, well, the logistics is a big factor. Nowadays, in a logistics business, you know, you are able to track your equipment and your drivers with GPS systems. You're able to track hard brake and incredible improvements with regard to safety. You're able to tell people where their loads are at, you know, what time and when. So you're able to have a much bigger, broader, precise picture.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're able to deliver that product safer, as well as you're able to monitor. Your software has come into the repair and maintenance side of it. It's come into the dispatching side. It's come into the accounting side. I mean, it's really being transformational about what you can do. Fuel mileage and fuel efficiencies. So
it's really touching almost every expense item, and then also the top line as well.
Yes, every aspect.
Linda, what about you? Technology is on the creative side as well as the engineering side. It's probably transformed your business over the last 15, 20 years.
Well, it really has. I mean, we've seen drawings go from ink on Mylar on a, you know, on a table to just zipping them out on a CAD machine and everybody being involved in that process. So it's exciting. I think one of the things that we rely on a lot now with the technology is really the advancements in communication, because all of our offices, even though they're located all around the country, we view them as one profit center. So all of our engineers are connected through cameras and headsets and visual connection as if everybody's in the same office. And that really transforms our ability to get things done in a very efficient manner and to train and mentor at the highest possible level. So it, I think the communication, being able to go to a job site, be able to have a camera that can go directly to somebody's computer and they can actually see something in the field that's going on, whether to learn or to help, it really transforms what we're doing.
For some reason that you made me think about things, a question I like to ask is, what do you do when stuff hits the fan? I just had a visual of you're halfway done and you have a critical issue that comes up and, you know, you have to relay back to headquarters or something. But talk about that a little bit, because I'm sure you have some interesting conundrums that you face occasionally.
Well, you know, when you're doing big things, you know, you're going to have some challenges along the way. And the best way we find to deal with them is to run to the challenge, not run away from it, but run as fast as you can to it and stay there until it's solved. And and it's really something where you bring, you know, no matter where people are at the time, you bring that focus directly on that matter and you get it solved quickly. You know, I think that's the best approach.
Right.
No matter, you know, how uncomfortable a situation can be, you have to get to it fast and not think it's just going to go away if you ignore it.
Babette, thoughts on that? You have multiple companies that you work with, and so I'm sure you have occasional fires that come up.
So we have a couple of philosophies on that. First of all, tell us the bad news quicker, sooner, faster than the good news. Secondly is we have a commitment that we are an airplane away and we will get on the first airplane if we have to. You know, don't cry wolf, but you know, we're partners and we're in this together and we've seen a lot of stuff. So we don't panic. You don't panic and you start addressing it and you go into very calm solution mode. The second thing is what we try and sort of preach in the beginning is how can we go from fighting fires to fire prevention, so that if you get your processes, if you get your safety, if you've put in your check and balance systems, hopefully you have a lot less fires and it's a little calmer.
Right.
But there's always a fire. I mean, you know, somewhere.
I'm going to shift gears a little bit and ask you this question very respectfully, but the construction and private equity industries aren't really known for having a ton of women leaders. And both of you have been so successful in your specific industries. I'd love your perspective on, you know, being a leader, but being a woman leader within your industries and, you know, how you have taken advantage of that or overcome the challenges that I'm sure you have faced over the years in that. But Linda, perspective on that.
Wow, that's a big topic.
And we can spend as much time on it as you guys want.
You know, I think, well, when I graduated from engineering school, there was only three girls in my class. And now today it's probably up around 20%, maybe. It depends on which area of engineering. Structural engineering, maybe not quite as much. I think over time, you know, you become sort of oblivious to the fact that you're the only woman in the room. Mm. And it just becomes something that, you know, we're all people and we're working together. I think I'm more aware of it now than I was even, you know, through the earlier part of my career. Because there is stronger efforts to help mentor young women than there ever has been. Mm-hmm. For instance, Auburn University now has this 100 Women Strong program where they call on, engineers that have graduated from Auburn who will help mentor new girls going into the engineering program. Because those first 2 years are a little bit of a struggle,
right?
And it's hard for anyone to stay the course in the program. So I think that is doing that. There's a lot of scholarships. We certainly have a lot of women in our group because they like to create wonderful bridges. So that's good. So I think that's, I think we've been maybe propelled into more leadership roles because to set some examples and to help to mentor mm-hmm. young women to see that they can do anything that they put their mind to.
Thank you. Babette?
Tough topic. Mm-hmm. There are very few women in private equity. There are especially there are very few women who are founders and who are on the deal doing side of the business. I wish I could tell you we've made a lot of progress in the past 30 years. I would tell you we haven't. Mm-hmm. And I think it's. The firms are smaller, so are not maybe subject to some of the laws of trying to, bring women into the business. It's you've got to be on the airplane a lot, so it's a tough lifestyle from that mm-hmm. perspective. There is a huge amount of capital and a huge number of industries that are controlled by private equity and are very, women are very underrepresented on that. I'm very proud of the fact that, we have almost 50% women. I have a woman partner that we're 50-50. I think we're probably one of the only ones. There are a couple of firms that are all women, but it's really a challenge in this business. I'm a member of something called C200, which is the Committee of 200. It isn't so much private equity as it is women leaders trying to help going into the business schools and trying to be a role model. But you generally see a lot of women going off into finance. You see women going off into marketing. You'll see women in private equity in the marketing roles, in an investor relation role, and in a CFO role. We have to shift them over into the deal doing side.
The origination side is a little bit more challenging.
Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned C200. Other organizations that you found helpful or that you'd suggest for people to spend some more attention? Sounds like connections with universities are a great way for people to get involved in mentoring as well.
Yeah, and I'll give a shout out to Emory, which is at the business school. They've actually started an institute around private equity, mm-hmm. and so there are pockets, not necessarily geared towards women. But toward the business school. So there's opportunities, but if you go into the private equity class where I've had the opportunity to be a lecturer, there's 80 guys and 2 women. Mm-hmm. So it's really got the industry has a challenge to try and bring people into it. The other side of it is, frankly, women don't invest in private equity all that much, or if they do, they've abdicated it over to advisors. And so it's interesting to, there are a lot of women on the investment side or not so much on the deal doing side.
Hmm. Interesting. We're blessed at Atlantic Capital to have a great team of bankers and about I think more than half of our team is experienced 25 plus year bankers, and so we're really blessed to have that. So shout out to them.
Keep going. But you know, all of us have to remember to reach back. I mean, the only way you're going to make it be an exciting career opportunity is you got to reach back and continue to, you know, encourage people to take risks and to come and try some things, and that goes on both sides. So that isn't male or female. It's just you got to reach back.
Got to reach back. That's a great admonition for all of us. Also, both of you are critically involved in partnerships. Linda, you're partnering with the communities and your customers to create this work of art that's also getting you from one place to another. Babette, you're really partnering with your companies that you're investing in. How do you maximize that partnership? Linda, thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think my philosophy on pretty much everything is it goes down to communication. You know, I mean, the people that you surround yourselves with have great knowledge and experience and aptitude and everything. But the key thing to getting things done is communication. And so whether we're doing a new bridge in a community that they've never seen before or they're very excited about it, is communicating with them as partners from the very beginning, getting them out there to the site, getting them engaged in the bridge, making the bridge a part of their lives in a different way. You know, that partnership is to really help make their lives better, not just, you know, one key part is crossing, you know, making the crossing. But the other part is how does that advance their lives? Like on the South Norfolk Jordan Bridge, we have a commuter club. So every time you use your Easy Pass, you get points, and those points translate to coupons to local businesses. And so there's this communication and connection and partnership with a whole lot of people. So we're kind of a facilitator for those partnerships. But, you know, I think the other key part is you know, just what Babette was saying is that you have to really enjoy and like the people that you're working with, and that is fundamental to what you're doing, and that creates great partnerships. And so a lot of the development of those partnerships from my perspective turn out to be based on intuition, on gut instinct, on you know, really being able to communicate effectively and get things done.
Communication is communicate, right? It's part
of the three C's of private equity: communication, chemistry, and cash.
There we go.
There it is.
but she's right. Communication is up and down. So for me, it's communicating to our investors and to being completely transparent. You know, I always tell them it's their money. They can ask any question. They can see any number.
Right.
And we give them voluminous documents filled with every piece of data that we can think of. And so we want to be completely transparent up, and we want to be transparent down. So we get daily numbers from all of our portfolio companies. So I get an email and I can tell you what and it goes to our whole team, and it goes to our whole, goes to the management team of that company. So there's no hiding. You know, it's kind of like we got a problem, run toward it, solve it. I don't need to wait for the financials to come out. If we've got a receivable issue, let's talk about it and solve it. So we get in front of that problem.
And you both have... You're regularly in the business of finding the next project or finding the next company. How do you go about doing that? You both have built very effective, for lack of a better term, sales organizations or origination organizations. But love your perspective on that, Linda. How you've built that engine for next.
Well, we run our company on a series of councils. We have like a design council, a management council, a new business development council. We actually have seven different councils, and those represent leaders in our organization from various different offices and areas of responsibility. So our new Business Development Council is really out in front of searching out those potential bridges that are going to come out to either be advertised or that we know will need to be replaced sometime soon. You know, sometimes from the time we identify a project to the time we actually maybe awarded it is about a four-year window. Mm. So it's a very long process. And has to be managed effectively, and there are projects that kind of come and go. But we stay in very close communication with the states and local governments and also some international through the Inter-American Development Bank or the World Bank to know where those projects are that we can serve the best.
So your pursuits sometimes are truly multi-year. That's remarkable. Yes. That so it's about tenacity and persistence, I would think, at a certain point.
It's just that never give up attitude.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Babette?
Yeah, our marketplace generally where we find our transactions tends to be from the smaller investment banks it's a two-man shop in Fort Collins. It's a smaller investment bank in Houston. We have a reputation that we are a fair buyer. We're not a crazy buyer. Mm-hmm. But we're also not a bait and switch. So people know that we are looking for that partnership. So if somebody wants to sell and they've talked to their advisor and said, look, I'm done, I want to go off to the beach, I'm not going to be that buyer.
Right.
And what we have garnered a reputation really of we say what we're going to do, and if we get uncomfortable, we put our pencil down. We're not retraders. And so they've come to trust us. So we will get the phone call that says, I've got a company that you need to take a look at, and I want you to meet these people. That just comes from 30 years of being in the business, and then people have worked with us, and they've seen us perform. And so that's really where a lot of it comes from. And then the second place is probably 50% of our deals are what I would call broken auctions, where they have entered into an agreement with someone, and it's been bad behavior or something has caused them, and they've circled back and said, you know, we really liked you guys.
Right.
Can we now talk to you?
We're kind of exhausted by the process now, and we really want to talk to a professional.
So that's where a lot of our deals come from.
Great. Love to ask everyone what the best business advice you ever received was. Linda?
Well, that would come from my father, and I think it was sort of advice throughout my whole life, which was you can do anything you put your mind to. Mm. And so, you know, I've always thought that as long as I was engaged and put my mind to it, that there wasn't anything that I couldn't do. And that were words of courage that have helped me with everything.
Mm. Great. Babette?
The only thing you have in this business is your reputation. Mm-hmm. So don't cut corners. I said it before, which is own up to your mistake sooner rather than later. And as a result, always keep learning. What I was told was no one can take away your education and no one can take away your experience of travel. So you may screw up or do something that has an economic impact, but if you have kept your reputation and you've been honest about it and you keep learning, you will figure out another way to solve a problem.
Great wisdom. I'm inspired. Thank you. I want to shift to our speed round. This is where I ask you some random questions, so bear with me. Linda, what did you want to do when you were growing up?
Well, I always liked creating things with my hands, and I always loved math. So, when I was younger, I loved to sew. So, like in high school, I sewed all my own clothes. When I was 9 years old, I wanted to build a treehouse, but my parents thought that was kind of strange for a 9-year-old little girl. So I went around the neighborhood trying to collect pieces of wood, but I never could come up with enough to make my treehouse. So I think, you know, it all kind of culminated in the fact that, you know, creativity and math, by the time I got to high school, I really wanted to be an engineer.
That's remarkable. Wow. Babette?
Well, so, you know, in your wildest dreams, you know, I wanted to be a singer, but in seventh grade, I was asked to be a silent singer by my choir teacher, so that kind of killed that career.
I'm right there with you.
And my children asked me not to sing in church, so that sort of tells you about that. So I was always, you know, my passion is I've always been an outdoor person, and so that's why I was sort of going down the biology route, mm-hmm. and thought I would try and get into the biology side or venture capital, but I ended up on the finance side, but that's okay.
Great. Well, thank you. How about favorite book or business resource that you've recently read or been exposed to?
Well, I'm kind of a book fanatic, because if I go to a bookstore, I'm going to walk away with a basket full of business books, and it's just, you know, I love to read. But I think the most significant book for me as I was taking over the company from my father was a colleague who was not in our company suggested that I read a book called Good to Great by Jim Collins. And it really helped me understand the definition of leadership, because I wasn't sure what the leadership style was that was going to be needed to carry this company further. So I was able to see that perhaps, you know, that it wasn't a formula, mm-hmm. you know, and the book Good to Great was wonderful. Another book that we use a lot is a book called Hiring Smart. I actually found this book at 3 o'clock in the morning at a Kinko's when we were putting together a presentation for the next day. We had made some changes and we had to print it out. So I was looking through the books, and it's about 45 ways to predict winners. Hmm. And so actually our recruiting council uses this to help define and find the people that fit the best in our organization. So that's another cool book. But I could go on and on with books. So
great. Thank you. Those are excellent resources. Absolutely. Babette, thoughts on that one?
So I have two. One is... politics aside, is a book called Success by the Koch brothers and The Secrets of Success. And it's really about how they evaluate their people and try and again, it's all about people, and it's finding great people and having smarter people around you. The second one, if I really get stuck and the market's going crazy and I get frustrated, I go back and I read parts of Security Analysis by Dodd Graham, and, you know, go back to value investing and go back to the basics. And, you know, we are very disciplined, and so sometimes you want to go with the crowd and you have to pull yourself back and say, okay. And then maybe the other one is kind of the biography of Warren Buffett, which is a same concept of, mm-hmm. right, pull yourself back and the power of numbers and compounding numbers. And if you know, hold and build and do it the right way, it's amazing what happens.
Graham was the investor that Warren Buffett really looks to. Is
right.
Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah.
Great. And then finally, what's your favorite charity or organization that you're involved with?
Well, I think it's, you know, Habitat for Humanity. I mean, there's so many charities that we like. This is one as our FIG team group gets very involved in. We've built 5 Habitat homes, funded and did the labor for them, and that was very exciting. We've recently got involved in another one that I like a lot called Bridges to Prosperity. It's where teams go over to, you know, disadvantaged countries and help them build bridges and communities. And so we just worked with the first initiative at Penn State with their college students on a bridge in Panama. And it was, you know, it was very exciting. That was accomplished this summer. So it's a pretty new organization, but they're doing some great things to help, you know, other countries get bridges built.
I bet when Habitat for Humanity hears that the FIG employees are coming, they are thrilled. Talk about a skilled workforce for Habitat. That's incredible. When they hear that the Atlantic Capital folks are coming, they kind of go, uh-oh. But the FIG folks, they'll get it done on time, under budget. That's great. Babette, you're involved in so many things in the community. What are some of the areas that you're really focused on these days?
I have two right now that are near and dear to my heart. One, of course, is the Atlanta Botanical Garden, which now is in great hands and has a wonderful leader there. It is the place where I found peace and joy and really connected me to Atlanta. So I'm very passionate about that. The one that I'm working on hard right now is really the Rollins Center at the Atlanta Speech School, where we are retraining teachers in the school systems and in the early learning system, because one of the facts that is heartbreaking is that children in the after-school in the MILK program, by the time they get to third grade, they have heard 30 million words less than a child that may be in your home or mine. And the number one predictor of jail cells is third grade reading scores. And so what we're doing is trying to go back and we know how to prove out how to teach language literacy on the teacher and on One Touch. What we're doing right now is also working on developing what's called the Cox Campus, so it can be online teaching to the teacher, so that a teacher in rural Georgia or South Africa can come on for free, learn a lesson, and take that lesson back into their classrooms. So, big challenge, big thorny issues, but if we're going to have transformational change in our educational system, we got to get these kids earlier and sooner and faster. That's the big one I'm working on now.
Great. Thank you both. This has been just so much fun to be with both of you this morning. Linda, how can our listeners learn more about FIG Bridge and perhaps contact you?
Well, our website,
FIG Bridge, is awesome.
Oh, thank you. Well, I was going to say the same about yours.
go visit. It's beautiful, if nothing else.
At figbridge.com, you see a lot of bridge pictures of bridges around the country that we worked on, and there's also contact information for us.
Great. Thank you. Babette.
And we're the same, which is linkspartners.com, and you can find the information there and reach out to us there.
Excellent. So. Thank you both.
Thank you, John.
And
you, John.
Join us again next week for another Founders Club broadcast, sponsored by Atlantic Capital Bank and powered by Business Radio X.